And let us introduce our speaker, Ken Long, today. Just well, a few short bio, which I found interesting. So Ken leads the development of LARA, we will hear today, from Imperial and as part of PPD. LARA activities are supported by the Center for Clinical Application Particles, also called CCAP, which Ken is the director. This is a multidisciplinary collaboration of personnel from various research fields and groups. His research interests also include the development of the muon accelerator to serve the future high-precision neutrino experiments and as the basis for the multi-TV muon collider. So he was a spokesperson of the MICE experiment, muon ionization cooling experiment. And these activities culminated in the publication in the Nature of the demonstration of ionization cooling. So what the topic that binds all these activities is also based on this fixed field alternating gradient accelerator technology, which is essential both for LARA and the muon. So over to you.
Thank you. Reducing number of cells, so I presume great to be back. 100 years ago, I was a postdoc in PPD, so it was really impossible. I couldn't go and spend many more years in my session. So, this is a very different project, and I hope by the end of it, you're going to be really enthused because it's a good thing. So, let's start with the grand motivation. Everybody knows that cancer is a big challenge. Half of people will get cancer during their lifetimes. It's the most common cause of death across the world, or the second most common cause of death across the world. The first is coronary heart disease, I think. There's a significant growth in demand projected. If you look at the, let's say, the high-income countries, where the record is, there's a doubling predicted between now and 2035. That doesn't take into account of all the places where the statistics are not being kept, so the lower middle income countries, where there's enormous unmet need. So in order to meet that projected unmet need and the sort of estimated unmet need, you really need new techniques which can be rolled out more broadly. The motivating thing for me, if you look at the radiation therapy, which is used in 50% of cancer treatments, is implicated in 40% of cancer cures. Today, the systems, the X-ray systems are relatively compact, but the particle beam systems are enormous. That really comes down to the beam delivery system. But the patient restraint, in order to keep the patient still, stop organs moving, and to be able to reproduce the position between treatments, they are quite, I find them quite scary. So I pick out a scary version of a head restraint for a patient. And honestly, if you think about the triggering activity at LHC, the decisions you make in a microsecond, if you could roll those out into radiotherapy, there's nothing in the human body that moves very far in a microsecond. So there's really an opportunity to harness novel techniques for clinical benefit. And sort of I just want to say this now, in the sense of how do you develop particle physics, let's say beyond FCC, we really need new acceleration techniques in order to take the energy frontier further. And maybe this is one. Right. So why particles instead of photons? At some point in such talk, everybody has a slide like this. So the right-hand side is treatment of a spinal tumor done with X-rays. The beams are shot in from the back, and you can see that the dose is concentrated around the spinal cord, but there's a lot of dose being delivered into the organs in the thorax. So this is causing damage. It's a pediatric treatment, so the the person has a long time to live for secondary tumors to develop. If you deliver that using protons, because of the Bragg peak, so with the way that the protons are losing energy, you can confine the dose into the region you want. So there's a big advantage that's coming from the way that energy is lost. And well, I'm teaching you to suck eggs. Everybody knows this. It's in the particle data book, but the particle data book is plotted this way around if you look at it. So if you shoot protons in, they lose energy by ionizing the material. As they slow down, the energy transfer becomes more and more efficient until there's a place where they're not moving very fast at all and they lose all of the energy in a very rapid manner. So you get a very sharp peak in the energy spectrum. So this is a proton beam with a Bragg peak here. X-rays, the dose develops as the shower is developing. Then there's a place where there's essentially an exponential decay and you're delivering energy to the tissues for a significant distance, even penetrating the patient. If you look at heavier ions, so here's a line of carbon, you can see that the energy decomposition is more peaked, but there's a tail. The tail is coming from nuclear fragments. So your big advantage of proton beam is you can stop the dose by calculating the range. For heavier ions, there is a complication that you get leakage beyond the Bragg peak. Okay. People want to make something called the therapeutic window large. So on a graph without axes, which is not very good. So if you look at the response probability, so you either have tumor control or you have normal tissue complications. So this is descriptive. These are the probabilities of either good effect or bad effects as a function of dose. What you want to do is to separate. You want to be able to give as much dose as possible to control the tumor while having as little negative effects on healthy tissue. And that gap is called the therapeutic window in modern microbiome. X-ray therapy, as you know, is widely used. It's the most widely used technique in radiotherapy. Dose falls exponentially with depth, as I've to indicate. And that means that the dose is often limited by the proximity of sensitive organs. So there's a real advantage if you can use protons. That was backwards. Right. So let's look across the world. You want to have a wide, broad access to particle beam therapy. You look in the relevant websites, you can find that there are 70 plus. The number keeps going up slowly. So call it between 70 and 100 particle beam therapy centers in operation. Probably the sum is probably something which is concerned. So several or many are under construction. These are being developed. There's an incremental development of technique which is being done by existing medical equipment suppliers and, of course, research in universities and in labs. There are also new initiatives. So LARA is one, but there are, of course, others across the world. I draw your attention to the map, so you can find this on the web. Reasonably enough, the proton beam therapy centers are concentrated in the places where there's a lot of NOCs. So that's in North America, Europe, and in Asia. Okay. So let me just move on. There's some exciting indications that if you deliver the beams in non-standard ways, you can have clinical benefit. I wanted to just mention size because size is important. In the UK today, there are two particle beam therapy centers run by the NHS, which are based on cyclotrons. Cyclotron-based facilities have sort of technical limitations in that you can't modulate the energy of the beam which emerges from the cyclotron. So people put material in the way to slow it down. That degrades the beam. And the instantaneous dose rate is limited at extraction, and the current is very large, actually, if you have the right kind of cyclotron, but the instantaneous dose rate is relatively low, and therefore, in order to deliver high dose rates, which are indicated, as I'll try and explain, this is going to be complicated. If you look at the size of the building, the cyclotron is sitting here, so the size of the accelerator really is not the driving term. The way that the beam is delivered to the patient You want to shoot the beam from all directions in order that you can localize the dose in the tumor and limit the amount of entry dose and the dose to healthy tissue. So what that means is that the beam delivery system has a transport, but then it goes through what's called a gantry. So this is something which raises the beam, turns it through 90 degrees and shoots it back into the patient. That's an engineering tour de force. The gantry system weighs of order 400 tons, depends exactly how it's done. For ions, it can be even heavier. If you say you're on floor one of a building, your treatment room is on the first floor, then the gantry will be such that you take floors two and the ground floor into account as it rotates. Engineering tour de force in the sense that that 400-ton object rotates around a fulcrum, which is accurate to less than a millimeter, but it's large and complicated, and you can have two national centers in a country like the UK. So this is at Christie in Manchester, UCLH in London. So the other way of doing it is to use a synchrotron. Synchrotron is a little bit bigger than the cyclotron, as of course you know. So this is smaller than ISIS, but it's that kind of scale. You've still got the gantries. The advantage of the cyclotron is that you can make ions effectively and accelerate them to high energy. Now, of course, you have an enormous gantry because the beginning of carbon beam is very large. If you put LARA on that scale, so I admit I'm cheating a little bit, then this part of the Mellostrom facility in Wiener Neustadt, close to Vienna, is scale is like this. Obviously, we're not treating patients. This goes up to several hundred MeV. Our baseline proton energy is 127 MeV, but I'm making the point about size. Size equates to an investment cost, so we're reducing the size and therefore the cost and complexity of the facility. I think the other part that we want to be able to do with the laser-driven approach is we want to increase the flexibility. So different ion species, different kind of beam profiles, I'll try and motivate those in a minute in order that one can optimize the treatments eventually. It's not all about the accelerator. So it's a pretty picture, but it's supposed to allow me to say two things. If you reduce the size, that reduces the investment cost. If you increase throughput, in principle, you can reduce the cost per treatment, so long as the indications clinically are there. So we want to increase the automation. We want to monitor the motion, so both of the patient tissues and then in the LHC triggering sense, we want to be able to shoot the beam when the stars are aligned, and that way we can remove the need for the gantry and perhaps move a little bit, a 70 kilogram object, which is the human, rather than the 400 ton object, which is the gantry. Okay, and that in principle would reduce the cost of treatment. So I wanted to do a historical interlude because I think there's a message for it which is important. So probably most people here have gone to Fermilab, and there's the Robert Rathbone Wilson Hall, which is the high rise there. Robert Wilson worked on the Manhattan Project, and he came out of the war wanting to do something good with radiation. And he wrote a paper about how you could treat cancer with beams, so X-ray beams were already being used. And maybe just look at this figure from the paper that he wrote in 1946. He's got a proton beam with the Bragg peak. He notes that a single proton would be narrower than a beam of protons. He also points out the carbon would be more narrow, electrons would be more broad. So he's got the whole basis of the modern technique there. And they did develop a cyclotron, which was eventually installed at Berkeley. The other thing I wanted to point out was this is a Livingston plot, of course, but the history of the accelerated development and the use. So the cyclotron was invented, as everybody knows, by Lawrence around 1932. Synchrotron in 1946. If you look at the exploitation of that for medicine or for biology, the first biological studies were done with cyclotrons in 48, so that's relatively quick, but it's 16 years. Preclinical studies of the radiation of pituitary gland had to wait until 1954, and the first treatment for cancer is 1974. So in 1974, there was the SPS at CERN being built, I think. So it's not about the accelerator technique. This long gap is about how you control the beam, how you know the beam that you shoot into the patient, the instrumentation, and so it's the system aspects that have taken a long time. And okay, so we mustn't make that mistake second time with the laser-driven approach. So in order to have an initiative where we're going to use novel techniques to enhance biomedical research and eventually clinical activities, we need to be looking at the source of the accelerator part, the source to capture, and the novel acceleration in order to preserve the beam structure. We absolutely need to be masters of novel real-time dosimetry, instrumentation, image processing, and importantly, feedback to the beam. Because just like on the battlefield, if you're an artillery captain, you shoot a shell, see where it goes, and then you adjust in order that you don't overshoot or undershoot. I'm going to show you some data from what is known about radiation in tissue, and there's a lot of fundamental radiation biology that needs to be done in order to improve the treatment planning. So that, if you like, is the initiative that we're trying to execute, and I'll try and show you how far we've got. So we formed the LARA collaboration. In the funding landscape context, LARA was developed through the infrastructure fund to serve the ion therapy research facility, and that's allowed us to make the CDR. So a lot of the things I'm going to talk about come from the CDR. The mission of the collaboration, after a lot of discussion, is that we want to deliver a systematic and definitive radiation biology program using the techniques that we want to develop or we think can be developed for clinical practice. By doing this, all day, every day, doing science, we want to prove the feasibility of a laser-driven hybrid acceleration approach, and that way we'll lay the foundation for a transformation of blood gene therapy. I think the LARA collaboration, in particular, with STFC, is the bedrock, if you like, on which we can build that activity. Right. So we're going to do some science, but perhaps not terribly familiar science. First of all, I want to show you the data which is used in the treatment planning software. So that if you would go to receive such treatment, this is kind of the kind of data that is used. So if you look at the graph on the vertical axis, you've got relative biological effectiveness. So what that is if you look at a particular desired endpoint, like killing 50% of cancer cells or something else, this is the ratio of the biological effectiveness that you get with a reference radiation. So, for example, strontium-90. So the photons from strontium-90 are the reference to the reference, so the radiation that you give. So, for example, the proton radiation. So for a particular dose, you look at the outcome of your endpoint, so cell fraction of cell death, and you plot it on the graph. The different points are different measurements in vitro and in vivo. The value that's used in the treatment planning software is 1.1. And I invite you to look at the way that 1.1 does describe the data, but look at the spread and look at the variation between the measurements and in a way you'd love to do better. From a natural scientist point of view, it's also important to note that this RBE has an intrinsic variation you see there, but it depends on the energy, the ion species, the dose, the rate at which the dose is delivered, the tissue type, and the endpoint that you're considering. So if you like, there's a huge number of things that you need to control in order to get the right RBE for your treatment. If you look at heavier ions, so here there's a compilation of ions from proton to carbon, neon, and heavier ions. What you see on the vertical axis is the relative biological effectiveness, and the horizontal axis is linear energy transfer. That's dEdx in our jargon. And I just invite you to look at the spread. The heavier ions are less well known simply because there are fewer places where the experiments are being done. So again, a systematic approach would be very important. Novel beams. So typically, one gives radiation doses given in a uniform way that covers the tumor. And typically, it's given at several gray per minute. People have looked or studied different ways of delivering the radiation. So instead of having a field which is uniform, you can split it up spatially. The important thing seems to be that in the gap, the radiation goes to zero. So you have, say, a millimeter wide beamlet, a millimeter or so gap, but the dose has to go to zero in the gap. So this is spatially fractionated radiotherapy. Flash radiotherapy means you deliver the dose much, much faster. So instead of a few gray per minute, you're delivering 40 gray per second. So it's like 200 times as rapid. And in both of those cases, what people have found is the same tumor kill probability, but much less normal tissue damage. Okay, and that would mean that you could increase the dose. So I don't really want to go through the details, but if you look at flash, so delivering the dose very rapidly, if you look at the different images of cells, cultures which have been irradiated, you can see that the damage lesions are much less for the more rapidly delivered radiation. My point in putting this slide up is to look at the timeline. The effect, the flash effect, was really invigorated in 2014. After studies in different kind of small animal models, it was 5 years until there was treatment. So really, by studying radiation biology, one can make difference quite rapidly. So Josie McGarrick, well, she just graduated from Imperial, now postdoc. So she made a study of all the data which exists on proton flash in order to try and establish the correlations and to see what was important. So she studied things such as the mean dose rate and to look at different ways of quantifying the benefit or the lack of normal tissue damage. So what you're seeing here is she has a normal tissue sparing score, which please read her thesis or her paper to find out what it means, as a function of the mean dose rate. You can plot that and find the correlation. You can indeed find that there is a positive correlation with the dose rate, and then you can do some statistics on that. But I think that we would also think that a horizontal line describes that data quite well. If you look at all the beam kind of parameters and a variety of metrics by which you could look for benefit from the flash effect, the darker red is a stronger correlation, either positive or negative. And then there's a lot of statistics that you need to look at this. But I think my point here is that it's not compelling when you look at the data as a whole. There has been benefit, so I'm not saying that the treatment should not be done. I'm saying that the systematic study is very important to find out where the effect is most exists most, and how, and to try and understand it so that you can predict how it should be used. Okay. So a similar set of arguments for the spatially fractionated radiotherapy. For a brain tumor irradiation, just to set the scale, this is a normal uniform irradiation. And here are the beamlets that I tried to describe a little while ago. There's the same evidence of normal tissue sparing. Josie did the same kind of study. So here, this is the dose in the valley. It seems to be very important that the dose is extinguished in the valley. This is increased lifespan of small animal models that were irradiated. And here's the same kind of picture. And once again, I think you can see that there is indications in the data, but the data needs to be significantly improved in order to make that happen. Sorry, to understand the effect. Okay, so if you were designing the ideal facility in order to study this science, what you would love to have is something where you can vary the beam parameters in the time domain. So you want to be able to have short pulses, long pulses, span the gap between conventional delivery of low dose rate, very high dose rate. You want to be able to make mini beams and micro beams. You want to be able to do those at high flux, so sort of in the plasma regime broken up. You want to vary the ion species because the energy deposition changes with the ion species. You obviously want to change the energy, and you want to do all of that in combination with other ways of treating cancer, for example, the chemotherapies and the immunotherapy. And in fact, there's evidence that giving radiation therapy enhances the effect of the immunotherapy. Okay, so ideally, you would create a system which does all of that. I want to point out one thing that if you, well, this comes from the web, but you can look at the time scale on which different things happen. The interaction with the tissues of the beam is over before it started, sort of thing. So this happens in 10 to the minus some large number of seconds. Then there's a chemical phase and a biological phase. People are able to look at the evolution of the biological phase because after minutes or hours, one is able to study how the effect of radiation evolved. Nobody has made a beam at the moment which allows you to look at the sub-second evolution of the biological effect. So I think the time domain is a key performance indicator for LARA. We want to be able to exploit the triggerability of the laser source to study the time evolution of the biological effect. If we want to do all of these things together, we need to have a multidisciplinary collaboration. There are many initiatives like ours around the world, at least let's call it half a dozen. The way we have distinguished ourselves is we've really tried to forge the collaboration which is multidisciplinary from the beginning. So I think that's a key difference. Right, so that was all the introduction. Now I'll try and tell you about the project itself. So what is LARA? Well, we want to have, LARA stands for Laser Hybrid Accelerator for Radiobiological Applications. It's a novel hybrid approach. The laser accelerator enthusiasts want to get the high energy with the laser. We want to pick off the flux where it's large and stabilize it and then use slightly beyond state-of-the-art acceleration to give the energy for the treatment. Okay, so we want to take a laser-driven proton and ion source. That will allow us to overcome the instantaneous dose rate limitation, which happens at the interface between the conventional source, so the discharge source, and the first accelerating element, which is either an RF cube or the thing which is injecting into the cyclotron. We can pick off protons at energies above 10 MeV. Our baseline capture energy is 15 MeV. That's 240 times the energy that you typically get from a discharge source. And if you remember, the space charge forces are going at the power, they scale with the power of the energy. You can see that we can pack a lot more charge into our bunch than you can with a conventional source. We can make very, very short bunches, so between 10 and 40 nanoseconds in the length of the beamlines that we've got, and our baseline 2% energy spread specification. So that means that we can shoot intense bunches of charge, which are quite short. We can stretch them, of course. And since this beam on demand, when you trigger the laser, you get the beam and no delay later, we can get a triggerable arbitrary pulse structure, and we can do pump probing tissues and things which haven't been possible before. Right. So then we're obviously building this for the future. We don't want to have enormous energy-consuming, expensive magnets. We want to use electron plasma lenses, so that would use an electrostatic force coming from the, let's say, gas of electrons, which is going to focus the particles. That changes a 5-ton solenoid into an object that two or three people could lift. So we want to use plasma lens focusing, because it gives a short focal length for a small magnetic field and about 60 kV electric field, and has the same effect as a solid magnet. And then we want to keep this flexibility in the bunch structure. So we picked a fixed field automating gradient accelerator, so an FFA. That has large dynamic aperture, so we can do multiple ion species. It's rapid acceleration, so we can preserve the bunch structure. And in order to have a modest size facility, we've chosen proton energies, specified proton energies between 15 and 127 MeV, and ion energies per nucleon from 5 to 34 NAD-dependent flow. So that's the specification. A while back, we simulated the performance that we thought we could get with a state-of-the-art commercial laser, and then something I'm going to show you in a moment. And this is the performance that we got from the accelerator. So you can see for proton beams at 12, 15 MeV, and the fully accelerated 27 MeV and 33.4 MeV carbon, you can see the dose per pulse, and then the instantaneous dose and the average dose. Remembering that 40 grays per second is the flash threshold for you're supposed to remember for flash. You can see we can deliver flash doses in arbitrary time structure. Now that's the specification. So as we change the design, you have to come back to find that we can deliver that set of doses. Okay. So I'm going to try and show you the stages of the study, and I'm really taking results from the conceptual design report, which is all but ready. The editor, Joseph, she's ill, so we're not quite finished. So it's an almost final draft. We have to update the author list, actually, because the LMU colleagues would like to join us. So that, I think, let's say January, that will be finished, and we'll be able to show you all the design. I want to put the acknowledgement in at this point, because obviously I'm presenting the work of all the collaboration. I just want to point out the collaborating institutes are running from clinical oncologists, preclinical researchers, all the way to laser plasma theory. So really, that's an important aspect of what we've done. Right. So to produce the protons, we are baseline at the moment is that we're going to use target normal sheath acceleration. But what happens in that case is you shoot the laser in. It's an intense, so you put a joule of laser energy into 25 femtoseconds, and you focus it down to a few microns in size. That means that the electric fields, which are coherent because it's a laser, at the time when it hits some material, so this would be a metal or a plastic foil, are very, very large. That means that the electrons close to the surface are accelerated. They're moving in the field. Some are driven into the surface where they ionize. The ionization electrons feel the fields as well, and they get accelerated through the material, ionizing as they go, and they the electric fields are such that the electrons emerge at velocities which are close to the speed of light. So they recede from the surface very, very rapidly. They make a very large electric field, and they pull off positively charged objects which are sitting on the surface. So, for example, if there would be oils or hydrocarbons sitting on the surface, the protons are pulled away, and eventually the electrons are being pulled back by the positive charge. Eventually, the protons are leaving, and that's what forms the beam. I've just put in the figure from the original paper from Nature, where at around 1 MeV, people saw a peak of protons, and that was the start of the field of creating proton beams from laser-driven sources. Obviously, the field has evolved, and obviously there's lots and lots of work going on to increase the laser power and the rep rate, and produce targets such that the energies of the protons coming off are much larger. I think the record energy now is in excess of 100 MeV. So all of that is an active field, and I guess from the LARA point of view, we want to exploit developments as they go. Okay, so our R&D objectives then is we have been developing towards a four-tail test of a source in the conditions we want to have at LARA. We have specified 10 hertz and I forgot about a joule of energy, and we don't have all of those conditions at the moment, but at least we can make the we can get close. So the tests which are closest are actually at SCAP, but I'm going to show you those in a minute. We're focused on the diagnostics and targetry development because we need to have efficient production of particles, and we need to know what we produce. We want to have a high repetition rate. Our specification is 10 hertz, but we would exploit higher rates if we could get them. So we want to be able to demonstrate running at high rep rate for long times. And we want to be able to have codes which we benchmark against measurement so that we can simulate the performance that we would expect. Here's an example of some simulations that have been done, comparison of data. So the spectrum of protons that you get off a laser-driven source with TNSA has a feature that it falls in an exponential manner until it comes to some endpoint where the flux is dropping rapidly to zero. So in this case, you can see simulations of as a function of the angle at which the target laser strikes the target, go 0 degrees to 45 degrees, and you can see that you can either have a slow fall off, so you can adjust the rate of the decrease and the height and the position of the endpoint by changing the way in which the laser is striking the target. You can also look at the intensity of the laser and the thickness of the target, and we're trying to do those simulations at the moment. A particular thing is about stability. So this is some early results from SCAPA. So what you're seeing on the pictures is a laser preparation area in this big vacuum tank. In the octagon here, the beam is supposed to focus on a target, and then there's instrumentation which is sitting inside the octagonal vacuum chamber, which is looking at both the laser spot and eventually the proton spectrum which is coming off. So here what you're seeing is the endpoint as a function of shot number, and I'm inviting you to look at the fact that the spread of the endpoint is stable at the level of 5% or so. So it's very important that we would be able to control the flux which is coming, and therefore this 5% variation is something which is very encouraging. I'm going to rapidly show you the plasma lens development. So what we want to do is use something called a Gabor lens. That's really a gas of electrons. You put the electrons inside a penny trap. So there's a solenoid, which is confining the electrons in the transverse plane. You put that in a potential well by putting electrodes at each end so that the electrons are confined in the longitudinal direction. The electrons are doing some helical motion of being reflected from the potential barriers in each end. We made a prototype, which had various problems. And the beamline that we've simulated has seven of these plasma lenses, which capture the beam and then turn it into a parallel beam, which is focused, that we can transport into the biological end station. How do you do that? Well, if you've seen Alpha experiment at CERN, these guys have checked that antihydrogen falls at the same rate as hydrogen. And they've done that by having a penny trap which confines positrons, and then they slow antiprotons down in order to shoot them into the trapped positron. So these guys are the experts on trapped low mass states, so trapped positrons, and they're working with us now to develop the electron trap for Lara. In Swansea, there's what they call a positron beamline. So what that is a penny trap, which I'm trying to indicate here. They have a cylindrical electrode, which they've broken up into different pieces so that they can make different kinds of shapes of the potential. That's all wrapped in a solenoid. So from that black line to that black line, there's a solenoid, and inside that there's a cylindrical electrode. There's two Helmholtz coils at the end, which are there to shape the field. So they have a penny trap, and they have a flexible penny trap that they can arrange by changing the electrodes. The way they operate for Alpha at CERN is in this region here. They routinely store for a very long period positron plasmas or electron plasmas, which have about 10 to the 13 particles cubic meter. And if you use that as a lens, then your focal length will be in this case of a kilometer. So that's not really what we want. Our performance means that we want to have a focal length of order a meter. And that means we have to have a few times 10 to the 15 as the electron density. So the research program that this set of people is following is to go from the routine place here up to that goal for Lara. I think what they would say to you is that each of the conditions that they need to do that has been achieved on its own, but not yet together. Right, so here's the status of what they have been able to do. This is the function of position along the track. What seems to be very important is that the shape of the potential is such that some ions are trapped alongside the electrons, which are trapped on either side. The effect of that appears to be that the gas, which is trapped in this area, is providing electrons, which keeps the electron density high in the regions where the electrons are being trapped. And as a function of the trap depth, so the degree to which there's a potential well that electrons are sitting in, you can look at the intensity, sorry, you can measure the number of electrons which are trapped in the point of the trap voltage. So with other conditions specified, they are looking at the density as a function of trap voltage. We need to be up in this region here, and with the density, sorry, with the voltage source that they have at the moment, they're able to trap these numbers. So with the 400 getting it to 1 times 10 to the 15, so only a factor of a few less than what we need. What we need to do is plot this extension of this line, and whether we can, by increasing the voltage, trap greater density of electrons. And then, of course, there's the problem of stabilizing that to make it into a length. Our colleagues in Desbury have been looking at the engineering of this. There's a technical problem, because the vacuum you need in the penny trap has to be very good. When the laser is striking the target, this here produces a lot of debris, simply stuff which is pushed out of the target by the laser. So the vacuum in the source area is poor, and this needs a very good vacuum. So we've had to design some re-entrant nozzle system in order to have differential pumping. And the complexity of that area, I think you get feeling from those drawings, and that's really a development of that from the colleague in Jansbury. Right, we want to accelerate the beam rapidly, so we need to design for the Bixfield automating gradient accelerator. I pick out a cartoon of it here. There are 10 cells. There are large return yokes hosting the magnet. The magnet has a main dipole, a little bit like ice, if you like. So there's a main dipole, and then there are a set of trim coils which make the field shape such that the radius excursion as the beam is accelerating is limited. And once that's set up to a particular energy, the field is fixed, the acceleration is rapid, and we're able to do multiple ion species acceleration. We can extract a variety of energies, which is a key specification. We can have a high repetition rate because we're not filling the magnet and emptying them again, and it's got a very large acceptance. So we're able to have a large amount, a large beam. So the optics have been done. So on the, these are, if you like, typical plots, there's a function of distance around the ring, which is the beta functions. This is the X prime versus X, so that's the base space which you're transporting. Key factor is the design of the magnet. So Dudley and Crowe has simulated an opera to design the magnets, and so he has a consistent design that he's writing up in his thesis just at the moment. Okay, so we think we have a design from the Bixfield accelerator. Right, now back to the range verification. We have to be able to measure in real time where did the dose go. By definition, at the Bragg peak, you're not producing any signal. There's no nuclear processes happening because the protons are going too slowly. The techniques that people use in order to plot the energy deposition is either they use the prompt protons, which come from nuclear processes. People have used PET, so positron emission tomography, from isotopes which are created along the path. Both of these things take time to integrate photons, and they both are exploiting the nuclear processes that happen when the beam has significant energy. So in all those cases, you don't measure at the Bragg peak. By contrast, if you look at the acoustic signal which is generated by the shock wave, which is produced by an intense short pulse striking the tissue, then you're getting the signal from the Bragg peak, and you're able to and really reconstruct what you want to do. And you do that with acoustic sensors, which in your hope would be outside, so they would be on the surface of the patient. We tried to make a proof of principle experiment. I'll show you a cartoon of the results in a minute. What we made is a cube. It had a re-entrant system so that we could shoot the beam, either from a cyclotron or from a laser-driven source, into water. The beam energy being low means that the distance that it penetrated is relatively small. If you look at the energy position, so simulated the shell, in the transverse plane, you get a small dot, and then you can see the bag peaking in the deep position on the X and Y planes, and that's what we're trying to reconstruct acoustically. We did experiments at Cyclone in Birmingham, but also at the laser in Munich, at LMU. So on the left-hand side, I'm showing you the raw acoustic signal. So this is the noise that comes from the laser, and the acoustic signal is here. So this is what we're processing in order to find the magnitude of the energy from the acoustic signal. We were using liquid scintillator so that we could measure the optical response and correlate the two things. We think we can understand the liquid scintillator, but the optical system has been quite difficult to reconstruct. The cube that I showed you before is indicated here in front of the accelerator. This is the end of the vacuum chamber. We've got two cameras viewing the liquid scintillator and two acoustic sensors listening to the acoustic response. The reason why I haven't shown you the data is because we're trying to publish it and we don't understand the beam well enough yet. So please invite me back and I'll show you that. Right. Colleagues in Desbury have laid it out. We've also tried to work out costing. This is a rendered diagram. This is roughly speaking 70 meters long and 35 meters wide. It's two stories and there's a roof with solar panels to try and reduce the. But the in vitro radiation biology is happening on the first floor, so the vertical bends at the end of the beam line and after the FFA to serve the two in vitro end stations. We've conceived an in vivo end station at the on the ground floor with good access to the room so that the animals can be brought in and taken out and the fish can apply. I want to make a point about the end station and I'll play the video which comes from Los Angeles in order to do that. So we need to have an up to it. The costing that we've got at the moment is that it will cost 225 million. That means that now the science has to happen all day, every day. The uptime like CERN or ICE or whatever has to be 95%. So it means that your experiment, which comes after my experiment, has to be done efficiently. That handover has to be efficient. You may want different environmental conditions or different the variety of different things in your experiment than mine. So we have to automate it. So this is automation at the car building level, not really at the picking something out of a rack and putting it. So there's a whole business about the end station. How do you measure? How do you measure between pulses which are separated by less than a second? And how do you efficiently move from one experiment to another? So the whole business of the end station, the instrumentation, is as important as the accelerator. And we've only scratched the surface. Like, we know we have to do it, we haven't got to. And I think on the campus here, working with the RFI would be a very logical thing to try and do. Right. I'm probably over time, am I? Trying to say so. Proof of principle experiments. 10 minutes? Wow. Oh, really? Okay. I'll still go quite quickly. So, if you like, this is really the development of the last year. We've got a great plan, if you like. There's a self-consistent design for the facility. And now, is it better? Can you do the science that we're trying to, we're arguing is important? So we've had the opportunity to try and build a proof of principle experiment based on the Scottish Centre for the Applications of Lasers. I can't remember what the feeling is. So this is in Strathclyde University in Glasgow. Poplar is a proof of principle lasers for radiobiology or something, I can't remember. So what we have done is made a quadrupole focused beamline at the end of the proton source on the scalper laser in stress client. So there's just two pods. This has been done in various places, including LMU. What you do is you're going to produce a spot here if you have a perfect system. Okay. So this is a blown-up version of the photo that I showed you before. This is the laser preparation area. This is the target area, which is sitting inside the octagon. Out of the octagon, you're extracting the protons. There's instrumentation and eventually the selvage, which is sitting on the end there. Okay, so that's a detail of the end part. What we are doing is extracting from the main vacuum chamber, transporting the beam. And in this region here, there's either diagnostics or that's where we put the cells. The laser that we've got, so we had a test run in last summer into September. This was a particular shot on the screen, which is at the end where the cells would go. So you can see the focus that we've got is typical of the quadrupole in that it's across. We were using foils in order to make the beam more uniform. This is the flatness of the response. So if you look at the different conditions, you can see the spread. They're not perfect, but still quite stable. The degree to which we understand the beamline, I'm trying to indicate with this slide. So we had two different setups. They're distinguished by how far apart the quadrupoles are. If you look at the data on the, yes, the data on the right and the simulation on the left, I'm inviting you to compare the simulated result with the measurement in both for these two configurations. And I'm wanting you to conclude that we do understand the beamline reasonably well. So then we've irradiated some cell dishes. Because the energy of the beam is of order 10 MeV, we've had to make a bespoke form of radiation dish, cell container. These are glass rings. There's a mylar cover plate, and the thing that's got the liquid falling out, which is this bung arrangement there. That sits in a carousel, so there are 12 holes here. When we were doing the irradiations, there were a series of cell holders, and then each time two radiochromic films so that we can monitor the beam in situ. I'm going to show you some test irradiations that were done in Birmingham. So the system was developed in Birmingham and we proved we could use it. So this is cells grown, in this case, not irradiated. The clumps are things where you count the number of cells. We're going to look at the cell death, rate of cell death, and this is irradiated in formerly. There are different markers that can be used. And this is what's called a comet assay. So they you irradiate the, if you irradiate the cells, you break the membrane and the proteins are leaking out. So you're able to observe that in a particular biological assay. We have such measurements. So we did the irradiation. Those cells went from Glasgow to Birmingham, I think just after Christmas. And I have not seen results from that experiment yet. So. But I'm hoping that the irradiations we've done will be possible to, we will be able to show that we can measure the cell response just as you did in the cyclotron. Right, so that's where we are now. We've got to work out how we take the thing forward. So what I wanted to do is really reflect on how we can develop the program in 2026. Right, so the same slide as we had before, three main thrusts that we have to follow. I've just pasted in things which, so this is about focusing, so that's the Galvan lens. We have to do the rapid acceleration. We have to do the source and the capture, and your colleagues are working on the source in any case. Instrumentation is vital. At the moment, I think the biggest weakness of the activity in SCAPA from a natural science point of view is that we're not really master of the instrumentation. So that's something which we really have to develop very energetically. And we need to be doing this under member biology. A think an important thing is the development of the codes, which are there to interpret the data. So that's like GEM4. There are GEM4-based codes, but I think that's an important aspect of that work too. Right. So we need to build the activity going forward. So the collaboration has conceived a workshop series where we want to engage with the relevant peer groups. I'm working with the IOP. The IOP is considering sponsoring the series. What was new to them was the concept of a workshop series that was targeted at a particular thing, as opposed to a workshop style meeting. And they're still worrying about if they're going to co-sponsor. But anyway, so we are making a series of workshops. We'll start with the, we're calling it the Particle Therapy International meeting, where we're going to look at the strategic approach to the kind of research that we want to do and to get the funding for that. Then I think we're moving into more technical areas, so cylindric, symmetric, strong focusing for beams, so this will be plasma lenses and other things. Novel, time-resolved, high-resolution imaging, so this is critical for the interstation, it has to be designed in from the beginning. And then we need to be looking at the biology. I think that's a year's program, which is outlined on that slide. The first one is now set. It's on the 27th of February, 26. I'll change that before I give it to you. It's actually at Imperial, so it's in the Sir Alexander Fleming Building at Imperial. And you can see the rubric here. What we want to do is produce a short document after this, which outlines the consensus of the commissions and the preclinical researchers that we get to that meeting. That's if you like, an important piece of groundwork that we need to do. Okay, then we need to raise the money. Okay, so this is a challenge. I guess we all know it's a challenge. We've agreed amongst the collaboration that we're going to take a portfolio approach. I'm not sure we really know what that means. But what I think the effect of it is that we're going to seek money from wherever we can get it, which is logical. I think that UKRI, or Research Council, this is fundamental to making it work. So we have to create the conditions where baseline funding is coming from the Research Council, and we can enhance it with the very solid. But I think the key thing we need to do as a collaboration, as institutes within the collaboration, is make a business plan. The collaboration has to have a business plan which is able to encompass all the business plans of the different institutes. The institutes have to have one which maps that activity onto their institute. So I've written one for Imperial. I'd be happy to show it to you, but I would remind you that all politics is local and it bigs up Imperial. I guess you would expect that. I think it's fundamental that there's one for SDFC, and I think SDFC has a particular role because it's the National Laboratory Funding Council, and because of the two sites and because of the ways in which the expertise across the two sites exists. So I think the CDR is the springboard. We've almost got the CDR. Our next collaboration meeting is in April, and I hope we're discussing the Lara business plan at that meeting. In order to take that forward, we've got to make the case. Okay, 2025, we did the Great Exhibition Europe Festival of Science. That led to the invitation to present the same presentation when President Macron visited the Imperial to sign an AI activity between France and UK. And there was the open day. And we've made the same presentation there. This is really important. What I think I want to draw your attention to is that at the Great Exhibition Road Festival, which is the main picture, we were explicitly doing this with a key industrial partner, which is Leo Cancer Care. They are key because they are marketing, or they have developed this vertical patient position system. If you want to get rid of the gantry, which is fundamental to making it in order, you have to have a way of supporting the patient, which is not supine, not lying down. So I think they're a key part of this. This year, we have a stand at the Royal Society Summer Science Exhibition in June. We lucked out with Macron, really, because ministers and stuff were there, but we were able to make the case. This is a very important event. So, obviously, it would be lovely if people got involved. Right. So, This is now really the end. We want to use target normal sheath acceleration of laser driven proton beams in a hybrid system where we have novel or state of the art accelerator systems in order to really target the biology of cells. To do that, we've created the LARA collaboration. And I think through the CDR, through the funding from SGFC and UKRI, we really now build on that and have the opportunity to deliver the LARA initiative, deliver a systematic radiation biology program, prove the feasibility of laser hybrid acceleration, and lay the foundations of a transformation of clinical practice. Sorry for the room.
Thank you. Any questions? Nothing from the room here. Yes, please. I've got one question around the collaboration.
Yeah.
So when you put up the logos, I noticed a few universities in the NHS. Are you also with medical device manufacturers and people that actually then supply
final unit available? So on the slide that I showed you, so it's got to be updated now we've done the CDR, because that redefines the autolith. There was Maxella, which is a software company, Corrain, which is a software company, then sort of dropped in. But the key partner now is Leo Cancer Care. And I think we want to build that, we want to build on that. So if we can make concrete relationship with them, do something, not just trade show if you want.
Yeah.
Then we could reach out further. But that's a good, like, for the moment, for. Yeah, so maybe that's. Just to say, you could phone up, I have, like, you know, the big manufacturers, this scale is just, the difference is too big. Leo is an SME, and
yeah,
the discussion is much more.
Hi, nice talk. So the facility you mentioned at the end, the 250 million, maybe I missed it in this slide. What was the laser? What was the laser underneath?
That was the 10 hertz one joule, the one which is, who's got it? I think it's like the Lion laser or the Scaffold. Oh,
okay.
So it's modest.
Yeah, 100 terawatt scale rather than
EVA. Yes, and we haven't updated that. We chose that laser in 2020. We haven't updated it because we want to be able to buy.
Yeah.
Like that's not our, we're not the guys that are developing it. So we're going to keep passing a better name.
You probably have to add an extra 100 million to get. So stick with the office.
There you go. So that's
maybe a follow-up question to place. We're using 100 terawatt laser, and then you're saying, okay, as a baseline for 10 to 15 MeV protons, those of 10 grayish kind of region. In one of your slides, I think it's about 10 gray. So that's it. For that kind of dose, you may need like a more focal laser there, like petabyte class system, yes, to get a 10-15 MeV tens of gray. Because again, if let's say a couple of joule system like SCAPA or other other terabyte system, you may generate 10-15 MeV, but it's exponentially decaying spectrum.
Right.
The flux would be quite low at 10-15 MeV region. You see what I mean?
Right. So I cut out those. I'm not going to try and find it. So the estimates that we've got is 10 to 9 particles is what we have based those estimates on. So I hear what you say. We absolutely have to measure that. The first time we're out there comparing our simulation to data is at SCAPA. And those simulations are not looking like they're totally... So it's critical. Yeah?
Yes.
Delivering the programs is critical. At the moment, I've got no reason to believe that our estimates are not right, which is a weaker way of saying that they are. But it's great.
Any other questions?
You've got this workshop in February where you're intending to write a document laying out the key advantages. Can you leap ahead and summarize what you think that sort of one or two key advantages are?
Well, so I should This is my opinion as a natural scientist. I think there are two. One is the short pulse, so the huge the charge density, essentially, in our jargon. That means that the dose per pulse is enormous. And the second is the arbitrary time structure. So if you can map it onto conventional accelerator technology, it's like a LINAC flexibility. LINACs make these small bunches, but they're low charge per bunch. So we get one, it's a LINAC style bunch, but it's got a cyclotron style charge. And we're able to do it in a triggerable manner.
The triggerable is clearly a key issue.
And so if you, why do you got the gantry? Well, partly it's history, partly because you didn't think you could do it in a by having people upright. Partly it's because you want to shoot from many angles to reduce normal tissue damage, but to get a large dose of the tumor. So if we're able to do the reconstruction, so what has changed in 50 years? People have AI. Google, if you look at their website, can have complicated sets of people with each of them hugging each other, and they get the hands with the right person. It's phenomenal what they can do with the image processing. So the whole image processing has changed. Computing has changed, both in algorithm and in hardware. So the high throughput hardware, which would be we could use for that. And so the direction of travel has to be that the machine makes the decision. So you shoot, oh, that wasn't quite where I wanted it. So the next one is better. And that's a big development in itself, because you've got to prove that it's right every time.
Yeah,
sorry. And the other angle is, it wasn't entirely clear to me why you needed to redo or go back to the cell biology. It kind of
like you, I spent my career avoiding beams and interlock systems, and to have a treatment based on the data that I showed you, I find distressing. Somehow it works, right? So the treatments work, but if you could. So at the moment, we abstract. So natural scientists, we make a measurement and then we abstract what we understand from that measurement and we make a prediction for something else. The way the radiation biologists are working is that they do a set of experiments which are very complicated, and they infer what the pathway is for a particular set of, for an endpoint and a particular thing that you've done. And there doesn't seem to be the principle that allows you to abstract from that and predict what would happen in a different situation. So that makes it a very long process, because you have to elucidate each pathway. Plus the measurements themselves, essentially done by graduate students. So the cell preparation, the radiation, post-processing. So it means that if you read the biology papers, six repeats is a big deal. Because no, I'm serious, because that's and what you need to do is to move from that to 100, so that the statistical variation you can manage in statistical way.
I mean, clearly, the better data on that helps everybody plan, but it's not clear to me why you can't see without it. I mean, it feels like it might be
people able to... people aren't. I mean, that's why there are two things that we are treating people, but if you want to,
Ken wants to sleep well at night.
Yes, wouldn't it be nice if it was totally predictable? So size is one thing. So just to paint the picture, somebody at some point developed the MRI scanner such that it would fit on a lorry. Now you can take it to the valleys of Wales, and particle beam therapy is not going on a lorry. But it could get into a district.
No, that's clear.
Now, if you want to do the, if you want to make it really precise, then it's about the feedback and the measurement. And so now you've got to make the measurements, but you've got to be able to interpret. And that's why the data is important, so you can build the model. So we want to have the standard model, if you want to, and then be worried about how we break it, as opposed to having a set of data which is like
60s. I guess what I'm saying is I would be happy to do it without the biology side of it, demonstrate that I could deliver doses, do damage to structures in places.
Fine. Oh, okay. I'm not right, I'm still uncomfortable.
I think what we found in other fields, just on a similar topic, is that you get buy-in from those communities. So, like, if you're showing, oh, in my RCF, I get dose. Well, if you do it in a cell, you actually get to talk to the biology scientists directly and get their engagement on the project. And I think what Ken's built here is a huge collaboration with those other partners. I think that's the aspect that, at least when we've done it, not at this scale, that's where we've, that's why we've reached out to this.
I think the other sort of intellectually possible outcome. Let's say you build it, you demonstrate that immunotherapy, chemotherapy are way better, and you don't need this. It's too expensive, too complicated, too hard to run, you need too many experts. Great. So that's been something which is valuable, even though it's negative. So I mean, somehow that fundamental understanding, I think, would be important.
Speaking of building it, what sort of realistic or ambitious timeline, or sort of
well, so correlated with resource, so that's and sustainability of resource. But what Neil Bliss, before he retired, he thinks it's a 7-year project. I think that there's what we need now is the pre-construction R&D period, so that's. Well, we wrote it down. So we wrote down a program which was over 4 calendar years, and it had a value of 20 million. Well, I think that the next step is at the level of, let's call it 3 million a year for 5 years, and then you'd have a much better idea about how you would start. And then if you believe me, it's a 7-year bill.
Still about 50.
Yeah. So the... So they're in making the business plan and beginning to discuss the collaboration business plan. I think you could look at it in this way. In the 2040s, you're able to make the case for a clinical system. Okay, that means that in the 2030s, you have to be building this and you have to be demonstrating that it works. And that means that it's what I just said. What we need now is pre-construction only. So the peer group meeting series is about getting the cohort, all the stakeholders to understand the opportunity. And then you've got a plan on that, right? Because maybe there's a gotcha.
Do you think there's a fundamental lack of understanding? What do you think is the barrier there?
No, because we've simulated it also. So I think you have to do some. You have to do the R&D, but I think it can be done. You give me the opportunity to make a point which you haven't. But the 225 million is our estimate. Each system is probably 20 million. So let's say we can't do the sort of performance and reliability. So what we do with less performance, less flexibility, is we have a discharge source, we have an RFQ, and maybe a couple of 50 minutes, and we rescue the biological or clinical performance of the facility at a cost which is about 10 to 15 million. Okay, that's a manageable set of risks. You can put that costing into the project. And to the extent that we're developing technologies which could be used for particle physics in the future or post-proton beams in the future, it's a manageable scale of risk. But still manageable scale of risk. Whereas FCC, there's proposed FCC in the room, that has a conservative set of technologies because managing the risk in the way that I just outlined has a cost which is beyond the money.
But at least FCC saves lives.
It's being recorded. It wasn't an argument against FCC. It's an argument that our field, particle physics, I think it's not being a particle physicist, needs a set of vehicles where we can develop high technical risk.
Any other questions?
Yeah.
Thank you.
On that note, could you remind us there would be another presentation by the commercial collaborators on
what you could biological? Invite, yes. You could invite Leo.
Yes.
I don't see any questions, so let's close the seminar. Thank you again.